Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mullinger Meets Canadians is brought to you by the Cape Breton Partnership. Hello, I'm stand-up comedian James Mullinger and the co-founder of Edit Magazine. This is Mullinger Meets Canadians, the podcast where we meet Canadians who are making waves on the world stage. I'm very excited to be meeting one of Canadian comedy's hottest rising stars in just a few short moments. Clifton Cremo is a Mi'kmaq stand-up comedian from Eskasoni First Nation. In just 2 short years, he's become a fixture on the Nova Scotia comedy scene through his fast-paced gags and thought-provoking, uncompromising material. Nothing is off-limits in a Clifton set, particularly when it comes to politics, family, and his First Nations heritage. Clifton's unique outlook has caught the attention of the Halifax Comedy Festival, where he's scheduled to perform in October at Best of the Fest, as well as the Winnipeg Comedy Festival, who booked him for virtual fundraising events. He's also opened for Juno Award nominees Nick Nemeroff and Matt Wright. Whether he's on stage at a comedy club or a local bar or a theatre or even a funeral, yes, seriously, Clifton always brings the laughs. He's an incredible self-starter and a hugely driven individual who has gone out and created these opportunities in the Maritimes as a producer, in addition to excelling every night on stage. He recently hosted Tatterfest, the Tatamagoosh Festival, that also featured everyone's favourite New Brunswick rapper, Wolfcastle. Without further ado, let's meet Clifton. Clifton, it is so great to meet you, my friend.
Yeah, it's great to meet you too. Yeah, this is great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, not at all. I've been watching lots of your stand-up recently, and you are, you're hilarious, and it's truly, it's incredible to me that you've only been doing it for a few years, and yet you've got this kind of incredible ability to talk about very serious issues and important issues that need to be talked about, but you also manage to somehow make them both thought-provoking and funny. Where do you think you got that talent from?
I wouldn't know if it's actually a talent, but you have these conversations in real life with people that you're close with, and like you get kind of used to talking about it, especially when the issues are so close to you, especially like with my Indigenous issues that I talk about. These are conversations that I've had, and I'm generally kind of a guy when it comes to comedy who just doesn't turn it off. Right. So it's really difficult to have a serious conversation with me. So I'll be having a serious conversation about these topics, but then I'll make these quips and I'm like, oh, maybe I should write that down and do it on stage.
Wow. That's amazing. So that's essentially how you write your material, is an inappropriate thought to kind of lighten the mood or to highlight something pops in your head and you say it, and then that becomes the act.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of.
Amazing.
I try to write a whole bunch of different formats, but like when it comes to big issues, I think about that. I try never to punch down, obviously. Yeah. I try to be delicate when it comes to especially stuff like residential schools or stuff like that, where it has affected so many people in such negative and big ways. I obviously don't want to disparage any victims, so I'm always very careful, and I think I managed to pull it off.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is what I found so fascinating about watching you, is that I would be watching it and laughing, but also thinking. And of course, what I think I find so smart about it is that you could actually make someone who is bigoted think differently with your comedy. But also, as you rightly say, no one can be offended. There is nothing insensitive about what you're doing, which really is quite educational for people who say, oh, that you can't joke about this, you can't joke about that. And it's like, well, you can't punch down on those things. No, but you can certainly joke about them, as you've proven.
Absolutely. And I feel that way about so many different subjects too. Mm. Yeah. You don't want to punch down. You don't want to be bad to the victims, but these are conversations that need to be had. So a lot of the time post show, people will come up to me and we'll have these serious conversations. Like, you know, someone will come up to me and they'll give me a compliment. Oh, like you were hilarious. And then they'll say, what you said about this was very true. And then we'll start talking about the issue. And then it's no longer about jokes. It's about education. And I think that's part of my goal when I tell jokes on these topics, it's like to start the dialogue. And then maybe on the ride home, they'll talk about it with their spouse or they'll talk about it with whoever to just start the conversation.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really, really powerful thing to be able to do. And also, as I say, an incredible skill to have so early on in your career. I mean, it's really remarkable when I look at other comedians who ended up doing that kind of great comedy, comedians like Dave Chappelle and people that were able to talk about things that mattered. For the first kind of 5-10 years, their acts weren't that, whereas you've kind of hit the ground running. Tell me a bit about your upbringing. Were you around funny people growing up? And was humor something that you kind of did to cope with things?
Yeah, absolutely. I think being First Nations, being a Native person myself, there are so many funny First Nations people. And it comes from that whole idea of coping or telling jokes to get by, make things funny, make things pleasant. So many people have this skill. And I'm sure you've heard that where like Native people, First Nations people are kind of these like oral traditions, storytellers.
Yeah.
So I think just naturally, it's genetic, maybe. And like being around funny people, my entire family are so funny, except my dad. My dad's kind of got this dry sense of humor where it's like, he's the definition of dad jokes.
Right.
My grandfather, Lee Cremo, he was a well-known fiddler in the area.
Wow.
He had this great sense of humor, and that's what people would talk about. I'll meet some old person who went to like dances that he played, and they'll be like, oh yeah, Lee was so funny. And then we'll have a conversation and they're like, you remind me of your grandfather, because we have that same kind of sense of humor. And that passed down to my mother and my uncle, and they're virtually the people who raised me my entire life. So I kind of got this sense of humor from that side of the family.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And that's really beautiful. And it's true what you say, that the way in which, you know, First Nations peoples are depicted by the media and by, you know, TV and film, it hasn't kind of led people to picture it like that. There's always been, you know, stereotypes and all of these things. And yet our mutual friend Wolf Castle described the exact same thing. Tristan said that growing up, he was surrounded by incredibly creative people who actually were so funny and also so encouraging of creative fields, which isn't something... That's not something really anywhere in the world. I mean, certainly when I was growing up and I said I wanted to be a comedian, absolutely no one encouraged me. absolutely no one. Well, some people still don't think it's a good idea. Can you tell me a bit about the kind of point at which you kind of realized that this was something that you wanted to do and how you were able to kind of take those first steps onto the stage?
In terms of doing stand-up comedy, it was never something that I actually wanted to do. I guess it was never a goal. It was never like a, that's what I want to be when I grow up, for sure. It's just something that kind of fell into my lap. We talked about the supports that I've had with my parents, but there have been so many others. And the way I got into stand-up comedy, it's kind of just a funny story. I went to improv camp when I was a kid, and one of the camp counselors there, James F.W. Thompson, really funny guy, really great person. I decided that I wanted to catch up with him as an adult. So I looked him up on Facebook and I saw that he was doing a stand-up comedy night. So I was like, oh, I'll just, instead of sending him a Facebook message, I'll go to this stand-up night and talk to him in person. And then when I was there, I was just like, maybe I should try this. Like, maybe I should get on stage, try to impress him.
Amazing.
And, but as far as encouragement in the community, it's been really great. Mm-hmm. There are so many supports within the community, people who want to see you succeed. There are people who want to see you fail too, because let's face it, that's funny.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And it also drives us. It pushes us to be better and do more.
Yeah.
That's amazing. But tell me about that first gig then. So you ended up on the stage, you gave it a go. Talk me through that night and how that went.
So I had just come from my friends, Ashley and Bradley. Mm-hmm. They organized Squish Basketball, which is kind of like LGBT ally friendly basketball, because, just a fun sport, just nice. For fun. And after that, we decided to go to Daniel's, the bar where the comedy was at. And I know they're super supportive people. Obviously, they're running a LGBT friendly basketball league, right? I knew they were super supportive. And I was with some friends here from Escazoni here. And it's one thing to know your super supportive friends, but it's also another thing to have the friends you've known your whole life who are going to make fun of you if and when you fail. Yeah. So I asked my friends from Escazoni, I was like, can you guys leave while I try this? Just so you've got no ammo on me after.
Yeah. And did they? And
yeah, they left.
Like, oh, nice.
They were so supportive, they left the room.
Nice. That is nice. Because as you say, that is the terrible thing when you're starting out, is bombing in front of people you know. And it's hard enough anywhere, let alone in a small community when literally everyone knows everyone.
Yeah, it will definitely become the talk of the town if you tried and failed.
Right.
And also, but the other good thing is that it becomes the talk of the town if you try and you succeed and you get that support moving forward.
Absolutely.
So I've been lucky in that way, that I have a supportive community here.
You've hit the nail on the head there. It's funny. I mean, that's literally exactly my experience kind of leaving London and moving to New Brunswick, was if you are willing to get out there and do shows and work hard and do well, the word will spread quickly, which in a bigger place, the word spreads a lot slower. And of course, again, I mean, as you say, it works both ways. If you in a bigger city, you know, I mean, I always say this, in England, there's a lot of people that are shit at their jobs, from comedians to plumbers to whatever, getting away with it for a long time, because obviously everyone doesn't know everyone, but also no one talks because they're all a bunch of miserable bastards over there. But whereas here in the Maritimes, I mean, everyone talks. And as a result, if you do bad or you do anything bad in life, the word spreads. But if you do well and people like what you do, the word spreads fast. And that's what's happened to you. I mean, that must have been a wonderful thing to see and feel so early on in your career. People were talking about it and telling their friends. And as a result, I mean, as I understand it, you put on your own shows as well as getting other bookings as well.
Yeah, you kind of have to here in Cape Breton, put on your own shows. That is like, it's a very thin market for stand-up. We have a small scene here, but it's not incredibly active. I'm the most active person in it.
Right.
So you have to put together those shows to get the experience. Otherwise, you're not going to get it. And like, that's another thing that now that I'm talking about it with you or with Sarah or with whoever else, every time I have this conversation, I kind of realize that, you know, in a place like Halifax or London or New York City, you get so many opportunities to get on stage. Like Halifax has like five mics a week, five open mics. And like in New York, people will talk about doing five in one night.
Yeah, that's it.
All week. And like, I was at the peak of activity in Cape Breton here. I was getting one mic a week.
Right.
So I was effectively five times less experienced than anyone else in Halifax.
Yeah.
So it also kind of, that kind of pushed my writing. I feel like a lot of people have the luxury of testing out a bit on stage. If it doesn't work, let's change a tag. Let's add a tag. Let's do all this stuff. But with me, I feel like I have to bring it to the stage already polished, because this is my one chance.
Right. That's a really, really interesting way of looking at it. And you're right. I mean, that is such a huge part of being a comedian in this region, is you can't mess up once. You really have to, it makes our writing process a lot more meticulous, but before we get up there. And I've never really heard it put like that before, but you're absolutely spot on. And then of course the other thing is that because the same people are potentially coming the next week, you then need to turn over a whole new set by the following week.
Yeah, that was a big thing early on in my career. I'm still early on in my career, but when I first started, I felt like the audience was the same every week. It was always the regulars at Daniel's or the regulars at the curling club where we had our open mics, just the same few people, and my uncle and my parents. So I always felt like I had to have a new 5 minutes every time. Yeah. So I wrote so much material, and a lot of it I haven't revisited, but then I've been listening to podcasts with more experienced comics, and they're like, yeah, your first 2 years, you should just be working on getting a solid 5 minutes.
Right.
And it's like, oh, I have 3 hours here. I don't know how much of it is solid, but like,
it's amazing though, what you learn in this region when you're starting out in this region, or indeed at any level. I mean, you know, I mean, I've been doing it for many years in London when I came here, but basically had to started over with a whole new act, and had to learn how to do things differently. I mean, as you put it, like for the average comedian in a Toronto or a Montreal or a London, 90% of the gigs they get come to them either by a booking agent or by a club chain or whatever. Whereas close to 100% of what we do, we have to make happen ourselves. It's us doing it. And I think it kind of teaches a unique kind of hustle and a unique work ethic, which again is a very maritime thing anyway, having that work ethic. But I think it's an amazing thing to be able to build all that material. There's no doubt that you're going to, you know, going to break out and be hugely successful at this because you've got a unique talent. And then suddenly when everyone's wanting you for different things, you can go, they'll go, what have you got, 15 minutes? And you go, no, I've got 10 hours. I've got 10 hour long tours ready to go. I mean, that's a great position to be in.
Yeah, yeah. I've been like with all the shows that I've been doing recently, like the reason I'm doing the shows recently, by the way, is I work in the school. Mm. So I have the summer off. Nice. So it's the only time I can really get on the road without having to get back in the morning kind of thing. So having that kind of push me.
Your tenacity and drive is so visible. And I just think that's a really, really wonderful thing that being a comedian anywhere, you need that. Being a comedian, especially in Canada, you need it, let alone in Atlantic Canada. And I just think a lot of people could learn a lot from the way that you've gone out there and really pushed yourself creatively while also learning this thing, stand-up, which, let's face it, most people agree is a bloody difficult thing to do. I mean, it's the everyone, you know, people come up to us, right, and say, you know, oh, I could never do what you do. And then you say, well, what do you do? And they go, oh, I'm a fireman. And you're like, well, hang on a minute. Like, guess what, mate? I guess what I probably it's a lot easier telling a dick joke on stage than it is climbing through a window into a burning building. But thank you for the, you know, compliment. It's a crazy thing, but that's it. You have to learn all of these things, right? And that's what you're doing.
Yeah, I'd say that it's probably one of the bigger barriers here too, is that you have to kind of be a self-starter and you have to push to book your own shows and all of that. There's not just a pre-built scene for you.
Yeah.
And that's kind of intimidating, especially something that I found, like I don't have many credits to my name. I mean, I'm getting there now, but booking shows early on, it's like you're emailing a bar or you're emailing a brewery or a venue and they're like, who the hell are you? And you're like, oh, I don't know. I'm some guy. I'm hoping you'll take the chance, you know?
Yeah. That's part of it, though, isn't it? Is that the ones that do take the chance, you go there, you do a great job, they want you back, and gradually the audience is built. I mean, it's a, I always say that to people, that I think what I love so much about working in comedy on this side of the country is that there really is no shortcut. Hard work is the only way to do it. There's no tricking your way in here. Like, there's no agent calling in a favor saying, well, you can have my this act if you give this act a shot. There's none of that, because we don't have a comedy industry per se. It is simply just people going up on a stage doing jokes. If people like it, they come again and they get booked again, and if they don't, they don't. I mean, it's arguably the most organic and real place to do any type of performing arts.
Yeah, for sure. And like, speaking as a booker, you want to put together the best shows that you can so that these venues will have you back and that you can keep doing those shows and keep having that revenue stream. And then part of that is kind of being a snob.
Yeah.
Like, you have to. I've got a lot of friends in the scene, and like, I'm not saying that any of them are like bad comics, but a lot of different styles.
Right.
Where it's like, okay, this person would not work on this lineup, so I can't have them.
Yes. Yes.
And then you start feeling like a shitty friend, but then it's just not personal.
Totally. And I mean, again, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I've had similar things here. I mean, I used to book a lot more kind of mixed bill shows, 5 or 6 acts on the bill. And yeah, I would have people getting annoyed with me for not booking them. I mean, again, a lot of the time the people getting annoyed were the ones that actually didn't ask. And it was like, well, people say, how did you get this? How did you get that job? And I'm like, well, I asked. Like, I mean, I send out 200 emails a day and maybe 2 turn into something. But it was a weird thing. I would have people complaining that I wasn't booking them. And as you say, I mean, you have to do what's right for the show. I mean, for instance, if you are doing a show in an environment where it needs to be clean, there are some acts that will not be appropriate for that. And as you say, I mean, you can't play favorites. You just have to do what's right, because again, it comes back to that thing where you have one dud show. People's time is precious. And also in the Maritimes, there's a shitload of other things that people could be doing. They could be sitting on the beach. They could be watching their kids play hockey. They could be not wasting money on a babysitter. They could be just getting shit-faced in the garden. I mean, let's face it, that's my favorite hobby. I mean, like, so when you get people out, if they come out to your show and there's anything about it they don't like, or you kind of booked the wrong act for it, it's going to be impossible to get them back again.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. My other thing too, though, is if you ask, I will not deny you.
Right.
if someone reaches, like I've had people reach out like, hey, Clifton, I want to do a show in Cape Breton. Or do you have any shows coming up? I'd like to make a trip. I will go out of my way to put them on the lineup.
Nice. At some point, you know, like you'll find a way.
Yeah, for sure.
I read an interview with you. And again, I don't know this is exactly what you meant, but you kind of talked about doing this full time and all the rest of it. And you expressed this kind of thought that you felt you would may have to move somewhere like Montreal to make that happen. But to my mind, seeing what you've done on Cape Breton and seeing how you could easily replicate that model across Nova Scotia, across the Maritimes, and indeed across the rest of Canada, I don't know that you would need to move to Montreal, in my opinion.
Maybe not, but I do feel like it would help my growth as a writer.
Right, yeah.
I've done a couple of, I'll say shows, but like open mics in like New York and Boston, and my material falls kind of flat there because they don't give a F about Indigenous issues in Canada.
Right.
And like, it works here and it works in Canada, but like, I'd like to kind of broaden my spectrum. That's kind of one of the things that when getting started that I was concerned about. I don't know if you've ever heard of Don Bernstick.
No, I don't know if I have, no.
Don Bernstick is an Indigenous comic, and he does a lot of good stuff. He comes to the reservations. He does a lot of fundraising work for youth across the country. He goes to all these reserves. He does stand-up, and he's doing all these great things, but I always felt like that was all he did, right. You know? And it was like he could branch out, and I mean, he was the only Indigenous comic I saw growing up. I know there are a lot of great Indigenous comics now, but like he was the only one I was familiar with. And it was like, if I ever did comedy, I would not want to be pigeonholed into only doing that.
Right.
So like I always try to add some extra jokes into my set outside of the Indigenous material to prove that I've got stuff, I guess.
Very smart. And I mean, again, I mean, you're thinking about this long term, which is exactly, as you rightly say, I mean, when I'm performing in New Brunswick, all of my jokes are not only about here, but they're in a lot of cases very specific. Like, I mean, again, if I'm doing a gig in St. John, I'll be talking about specific people that everyone knows. It might be a local mayor, might be, you know, specific streets, which, of course, as you say, isn't going to work elsewhere. But I mean, what you've just described is absolutely spot on. You get on the road and you go to places and you hone different sets for different places. And just because, yeah, as you rightly say, you never want to feel pigeonholed, right? You want to be able to do the shows that you want to do, where you want to do them, and have solid bits for all of those places.
Yeah, I did a Zoom show, my first ever Zoom show.
Nice.
It was sponsored by Winnipeg Comedy Festival, doing a fundraiser for Fearless R2W, Manitoba-based child welfare agency organization.
Cool.
And I didn't know whether, because it's a Zoom show, I should like, should I try to do some local Winnipeg Manitoba material, but this is the internet. Like, we could have audience members from anywhere.
Right. Yeah, it's tricky. How did that go? How did you find the Zoom gig?
It was better than I expected. I've been reluctant to do Zoom gigs throughout this whole thing. Part of it is because I just didn't want to, like, finally give up on the idea of doing shows in person and stuff like that. I wanted to hold out hope.
Yeah.
So I've always been kind of hesitant. Like, even in the beginning of the whole pandemic, I didn't buy masks until they were made mandatory.
Yeah.
All of that stuff. Like, it was just like, it seems pretty bleak to make wardrobe decisions based on the end of the world.
Yeah, so true. And as you say, we just didn't want, none of us wanted to admit that this shit was happening, because also we're in the business of trying to pack as many people into tiny rooms as possible and stand on a stage and ask the entire audience to elicit like particles from their mouths into the air. I mean, it's basically the least popular job to have in a pandemic.
Yeah, but it's also the most popular because people need to laugh through this shit, you know?
Right, exactly. So true. And it's the number one job that everyone wanted to come back, which, again, I mean, like you at the beginning, I resisted virtuals, but I resisted for a couple of months and then eventually did one. And now, I mean, I've actually probably done more, about 50 or 60 now, and have oddly now started to actually enjoy it in a weird way. Like, I mean, obviously the audience are muted, but I can see them. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I quite like about them is that, and I did a live show on like an in-person show last week, and there was this guy in the front row on his phone the whole night, and I remember and just sitting there looking at his phone, and it was really, really bugging me. And I realized that what I like about a Zoom show is, obviously, if there's 100 or 200 or whatever thousand people on a Zoom gig, you can only get 20 on a page. They're muted, but I can obviously see them and I'm watching them laugh. If I get a page of duds and the people are just sat there not enjoying it, I can scroll through and find a page of laughers. Whereas in a live gig, I can't pick this arsehole up and move him to the back of the room. So there were small benefits to this.
Yeah, I think I'm too self-absorbed on stage to notice if someone's on their phone.
Oh, really?
Actually, best case scenario would be they're on their phone looking at funny memes, and then I can just pretend they're laughing at me.
Yeah, that's a good, it's it. And again, I mean, it's one of those things, if someone's on their phone, as long as if they're laughing, doesn't matter if they're laughing at us, or equally, if they're tweeting how great we are and how much they're enjoying our act, that's fine too.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're okay with that.
This show is brought to you by the Cape Breton Partnership. The Cape Breton Partnership aims to transform Cape Breton Unamagi into the most creative and prosperous place on earth. Visit capebretonpartnership.com to discover why this island is a great place to live, work, study, and invest. We are growing a culture that values and celebrates creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship.
So what's next for you? What do you feel like are the next things that you want to do, that you want to achieve? And, you know, how can people listening kind of find out about your shows and stuff?
What's next for me is, I'm not sure. I'd like to keep doing shows. I'd like to stay busy. And hopefully, like we said, with this pandemic and all that stuff, the Delta variant and everything coming our way, that we can continue to do live shows. Like I said, I did have an enjoyable time on Zoom, but I do prefer live for sure. So I want to keep doing shows. I want to keep booking shows. And like the tough part is like working in the school, I only really have weekends now to travel. And that means I can only book two gigs at a time, basically.
Right.
And then I'd have to plan super far in advance. And that's not the type of person I am. I'm very much a, let's just like when I wake up, I'll text you what I want to do that day as opposed to what I want to do next Thursday, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm always like that, but I'd like to keep booking shows, but I also have to kind of temper my expectations that it's not going to be as active as this summer was for me. Mm-hmm. I can book Cape Breton shows, but then you saturate the market. And then instead of having one good show, you have two very mediocre shows, you know?
Right.
But in terms of finding out where I'm going next, it's, if you're a listener and you'd like to see me, I'm most active on Instagram. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to follow. I usually post images with various celebrities with tour dates on them.
Nice. Nice. I mean, again, you, this is one of the things that's just impressed me so much, learning about all that you do is you're, you know how to put on a great show, you know how to perform a fantastic act, but you're also amazing at marketing. I mean, was there someone advising you for any of this, or did all of this kind of come naturally to you?
There was no advising, kind of come naturally. You can see on social media what works and what doesn't and that kind of thing. And you just kind of learn by watching. Mm-hmm. My job here at the school, I'm the communications officer. That's a bit more bland. Like we don't have a cool like Wendy's Twitter thing going on. So I'm not on the Twitter like being funny, which would be a great use for me, I think, but I'm not allowed. Unfortunately, I have to just post the boring stuff. Mm-hmm. But important information that people want to know. So you kind of figure out what time of day to post things, like weird things like that. You just learn through experience. And it's kind of like lightning in a bottle, my own personal or like comedy, this stuff. My friend Ardell, we do trivia together. She came to the show that I had in Glace Bay, wrote the article that you mentioned earlier and kind of picked up some steam there. And like, it's just kind of been organic, really.
It's really amazing. And I know you've got like a very cool show coming up at the Highland Arts Theatre in Sydney, Halifax Comedy Festival, Best of the Fest with Pete Zedlacker and Leonard Chan and our mutual dear friend, the great Travis Lindsay. I mean, it's really wonderful to see all of your success coming and the fact that you have this drive to kind of make it something even bigger. And I can't wait to see you live when we're all allowed to travel around again.
Yeah, well, we should do some shows together, you know? We'll do a little tour. We'll do it The indigenous and the colonizer.
I like it. That has got legs. That is the name of a term right there. Consider it done, my friend. And again, I mean, that alone sums up, like I say, what I love so much about your act is being able to just make brilliant jokes about things that traditionally no one should or would think about laughing about. When you do sit and write your act, do you ever shy away from bits that are just funny? Or do you want them to be meaning behind every bit? Or is it you're basically, or the gag is the goal?
Oh, no, absolutely not. There doesn't have to be meaning behind every bit. Like, I've written so many stupid jokes. One of the things about my writing style, like, just generally, I can kind of capture different voices. Right. So, like, I grew up listening to Weird Al. My Uncle Tim gave me a Weird Al CD when I was 7 years old. And I've just fell in love with Weird Al, the whole parody aspect of it. And writing stuff like that by growing up with it and hearing it, I feel like I'm able to write in other people's voices. So I feel like I'd be useful in a writer's room, you know, maybe. But I write so many different things. Like, I write poetry outside of jokes. I write short stories, that kind of thing, just to keep my brain going. But a lot of the jokes that I do write down in my notes, there's absolutely no meaning to, and they're so dumb. Like, some stuff will never, ever see the stage just because it's embarrassing, but I do write it.
Hey, you got to try it, though, because you just never know, right? I mean, Seinfeld always said that when he sits down and writes jokes in the afternoon to test that night, the stuff he thinks is good bombs, and the stuff he thinks is terrible, and he thinks, I'm not going to do that, but then just thinks, I'll try it, and that ends up getting the big laughs. We just never know, right?
Yeah, you do never know. And then it actually kind of bothers me when I write a joke and I'll throw in like a throwaway tag just to, you know, keep up the laughs per minute. Right. I'll throw in a throwaway tag and then that gets like more laughs than the one that I intended. Right. Like that kind of bothers me.
Hey, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things though, isn't it? It's like, it doesn't matter where the laugh comes from. I mean, last week I was doing a show, it's about 250, 300 people. And it was like one of those funny things where I live in a smallish area. So lots of people are coming to see me for the umpteenth time. So I'm trying to, obviously I want them to have a honed show, but at the same time, I want to be testing new stuff so that people leave feeling, every time they come, it's slightly different. And I did a joke about anti-vaxxers and it just bombed, didn't get anything. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, I've got to test new stuff. If I don't test new stuff, I can't stay fresh. And I said, buy a ticket to see me at the Imperial Theatre in April. By then, that joke will have been workshopped, honed to perfection. So you can sit in that audience and you can say, I saw that joke when it was shit. And that got a massive laugh. And I'm like, okay, so there we go. Because I did a joke that bombed, but and then improv something, that improv line is now something I will probably use again when I'm testing a new joke that bombs.
Yeah, that's something you can always, well, not always, but like addressing the joke that bombs or doing something in improv to kind of address it, and that gets laughs. Mm-hmm. It almost makes you like, oh, I want to bomb again so that I can see if this one works every time.
That's exactly.
Obviously, that shouldn't be your goal, to bomb.
But I think the skill is the fact of referencing the situation, like never ignoring what's happening in the room. And the audience can smell that as inexperience. It's kind of like if there's a big glass breaks or a car drives past or there's some big noise or anything happens in the room. The audience take it as a sign of inexperience when the comic just keeps plowing on and doesn't reference it.
Yeah. The way I would put it, I'd say, is that your job as a comedian, you're the master of funny. Mm. And if you don't realize when something's unfunny, how can the audience trust you anymore?
So true.
If you can address it, at least they know, oh, well, at least we can still trust him. He knows. But if you don't address it, they'll lose their trust in you. But if you have to address it too often, like if all of your jokes are falling flat and you keep addressing it, it's also going to drag you down. Like at a certain point, you have to kind of stop addressing it and just ride out the bomb, I think.
Yeah, that's true. You have to, in that situation, you have to ride out the bomb. If it's just one that's not landing, it has to be referenced. Also, I mean, I remember about 15 years ago doing an open spot at the Comedy Store in London, and after it was supposed to be a 10-minute spot. It was my first time doing a Saturday night there. I'd done a few Thursdays that had gone well. I'd been bumped up to the Saturday, got booed off after about 7 minutes. And as I came off stage, the MC came on and just started annihilating me, just like tearing strips off me to the audience. And of course, they're all in hysterics. And even at the time, even there at kind of... early into my career, I remember realizing why he was doing it. And it was very simple. It was because when he brought me onto the stage, his role as the MC is to keep the room together and to keep the show moving. And the audience need to trust him. And when he brought me up, he said, "Your next act, you're going to absolutely love him. Put your hands together, James Mullinger." The fact is, they didn't love me. They hated me. So he needed to show to them that he was still theirs, and that he wasn't some idiot that thought that the garbage they'd just watched was any good. So I kind of,
yeah.
You know, I understood what he was doing.
Yeah, and like, if you bomb and no one addresses it, like if the host doesn't address it or you don't address it, then like you're a black spot on the show. But if you can be made fun of, and if it doesn't hurt you too much, if you can be roasted like that, then you've brought your badness has brought some light to the audience at least.
Yes, that's true. That's a lovely way of putting it. Your badness has brought some light to the audience. I love that. That is beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
I've never been booed off the stage. Mm-hmm. I've talked about this before, where I've been pretty fortunate in that I haven't had too many bombs, mm-hmm. but the biggest show I ever did was the time that I bombed. I did a corporate gig and there was like 300-350 people in the room. Mm-hmm. It was a combination of everything. Like, none of the audience members gave a shit that there was a comic.
Right.
They all just wanted to hang out with their coworkers, and like the sound in the room, because it was a big room, big enough to hold 350 people, but not really designed to perform in. Like, it was just all bad. And like, I was just standing up on stage, and after you tell a joke, you expect laughter or applause, and there's like a little break there that you expect, but then nobody was laughing or applauding, so I was just like standing on stage drinking.
That's amazing. Yeah, I had one like that. I did a corporate in England once for estate agents, or I guess realtors they called it. It was just literally 400 people just talking to each other, like not even acknowledge, like even when I was introduced, no one clapped, no one, it wasn't like they looked up and then gradually kind of fell away from me. They just ignored me from the second I went out there. And I was contracted to do 45 minutes, and I was not going to get paid unless I did 45 minutes. So I started off attempting it. Like, I really did like attempt it. And I was going, "Come on, guys, come on." And tried everything, just tried doing the act, tried getting louder. It was getting nowhere. In the end, after about 15 minutes, I just basically started walking up and down the stage going, ba ba ba, da da da, just talking gibberish into the mic. But, and again, they still ignore me. But, if you can cope with that, walking up and down the stage as you're completely ignored, it sets you up well for what this business throws at you.
Yeah.
Terrible.
For sure. I've never tried gibberish.
No. Hey, sometimes, I mean, this situation, I just thought there was literally no point me speaking words at this point. But I hope that never happens to you. I mean, again, and this is, I mean, it can, of course, happen anywhere. But, I mean, English audiences aren't notoriously difficult, and I mean, of course, not all the time, and this was a unique situation, but I do find generally Canadian audiences, and specifically Maritimes audiences, love to laugh. And I think my big surprise when I moved here was just discovering that people came out to comedy to have a good time and laugh, whereas in England people go out to comedy just to ruin the comedian's night. So this is a much nicer place to be, for sure.
Yeah, we have some of the best crowds here in Cape Breton. Have you done many shows here, or any shows here?
Some. I've done a few. I'm just trying to think where they were. Both corporates, I think. But, I mean, such a beautiful place. And there's so many musicians and comedians from Cape Breton. It just has a intrinsically creative and, as you say, funny vibe. And as you say, I mean, the people there just are out for a good time. There's no pretension there.
Yeah, That's really great. Like, rate our audiences as some of the best. I've mentioned the open mics here a few times, but like the crowd there was always very encouraging, whereas I've done open mics in Halifax where like the crowd is just there to do other things.
Right.
They do not want to be there, but like we had kind of like a dedicated people who wanted to see live comedy weekly.
Yeah.
Coming. So that was really great. And like the wealth of talent, not just in Cape Breton, but in the Maritimes, like musically, I have so many people who are just so amazing. And a lot of them, like, we all want to see each other succeed.
Right.
And I think that's great. Like not just comics to comics, but comics to musicians. Like I've had friends who are musicians want me to MC their shows and stuff like that. And like, I'm very happy to do it because they're great.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is there's real crossover here in that respect, because we don't have a kind of this booming entertainment industry per se. We can kind of carve our own way in this way. No one's saying you can't do that. You can't have a musician and a comedian co-headline a show, because we can do what we want here. And as you say, and what you mentioned, I mean, I totally agree about the way in which we're all supporting each other, because not that we're not competitive, but we're competitive with ourselves. Like, I don't want to try and beat another comedian at this. I want to beat myself at this. I want to be better than I was last night. And I find it incredibly kind of warming in that respect, this thing that we've all kind of built here.
You hit the nail right on the head. You just want to improve. You want to see others improve. And like, it would be amazing if we could all continue to improve. We don't have to be better than each other. It would be awesome if we could go to Just for Laughs or something and have a Halifax showcase,
right,
or a Nova Scotia showcase, or like a Maritimes showcase, just because we're all doing so well. I mean, obviously that would be a very niche market for them to try to book a show to, but it would be awesome.
But yeah, but I think the thing is because Maritimers are all over the country, Joel Plaskett said that to me, that Joel Plaskett felt that the reason that he found success out west quite early on in his career was because he would go there and do a show. All the Maritimers or former Maritimers who'd moved away would say to their friends, you've got to go and see this guy. He's one of ours. And I mean, I think the only reason that I can sell out rooms in British Columbia is simply because people from New Brunswick have told friends there, or people from here have moved there. And so it's interesting how the kind of tentacles of the Maritimes spread quite widely. And it's just funny, I just remembered where two of the gigs that I've done on Cape Breton, one was at the Member 2 Convention Centre with a comedian called Mark Walker. It was the first anniversary of me moving here. So I remember it was the 14th of February 2015, absolutely magical, magical night. And then a couple of years later, me and Dan Hendricken and Ian Black did one in Port Hawkesbury in a community hall there. And again, both those shows, undoubtedly two of the most electric shows I've ever done. So, I mean, partly because of the amazing, those guys, I'm sure you know Dan and Ian, incredible, incredible comedians who just kind of bring a real electricity to any show. And both of those shows, I remember being there and just thinking, there are not many clubs in New York or Toronto or London right now where the audience is as alive and we're all having this shared experience that is so, you know, people just falling about laughing, you know, and just this kind of amazing, there's nothing like it. And there's no cynicism, I find. And I love that. I love that about East Coast audiences.
Actually, the first show that I went to as an audience member after I started doing stand-up was in Iona. Dan Hendricken was on it. Ian Black wasn't. But it was Dan, Travis Lindsay, and Nick Martinello. And it was just like so cool seeing such great stand-up from relatively local people. It was very encouraging that they could put on such a good show.
It's
a big part of why I wanted to continue.
It's beautiful. Well, as I say, I mean, I can't wait for us to hit the road, and I can't wait to see you and hang with you. I guess one of the things that I wanted to ask on a kind of a serious note is, do you feel like with this year's devastating revelations about residential schools, this is going to change anything? Like, do you think that now it's going to make a difference to people demanding solutions and answers from the government? Or is it all lip service? Is this a turning point for all of us?
It's tough to say. It really is. The revelation aspect of it is not a revelation to our people.
Right.
Right.
That's like, a good point.
These are stories that we've had our entire lives. Mm. It's not way back in the past. It's my grandmother.
Right.
It's some of my friends' parents. Mm. it's very, very new. And it's conversations that we have had. Like I went to school here in Escazoni, and that was like part of our education in Mi'kmaq class. They'd bring in an elder, you know, to speak to us, and they would talk about residential school. Mm-hmm. And it's almost kind of shocking to find out now as an adult that not everyone got that.
Right.
Not everyone got that kind of education about it. And hopefully moving forward that there is more education, more conversations about it. But with the way news media and attention spans work, a lot of people are already forgetting. Mm. And that's a big reason why I do the jokes on stage, that I start these conversations. We're on Zoom right now. You saw that I'm wearing an orange shirt. Mm. It's kind of like, I don't wear it every day, but like whenever I'm doing some kind of event, I want people to see it just so it's somewhere in the back of their mind,
yeah.
You know, to keep these conversations moving, because people will forget. And like, in terms of, is it going to provide actionable things? Who knows? Because the people who are having the conversations right now are incredible allies. They are incredible people, like Native people and allies across are having these conversations. But when it is coming from the government or from people who have kind of a way to action,
yeah,
it's yet to be determined if it's going to be lip service.
Right.
And unfortunately, trending so far, it does seem to be lip service. You know, you see, I mean, I don't want to get too political, but you'll have someone, MP or a prime minister, mention these things, mm-hmm. but then continue to fight Indigenous children in court, to fight against moderate livelihood fisheries, mm-hmm. to keep pushing us down while saying they're not. So it's like, hopefully that can change.
Yeah.
But it's been a tough 400 years. it's hard to see the end of the tunnel when you've been digging for 400 years.
Right. Absolutely spot on. And what is so just awful about the situation is that people just only learning about this now, when they've been being told for decades that this happened. Indigenous peoples have been shouting about it. It's not like, as you say, it was never a secret. And yet only now are people suddenly actually aware. And it's like 5 minutes of people saying, oh, that's terrible. And government kind of coming on TV and looking sad about it. But then through their actions, actually proving that nothing's changed.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
Right.
Yeah, I read a book. It's a book by Cliff Nesteroff about Indigenous comics, and is basically kind of like almost an autobiography of Charlie Hill. Mm-hmm. And just seeing all of the issues that he was pushing and all these other trailblazers of Indigenous comedy were pushing years and years ago in the 60s, 70s, seeing the activism that he was doing with the American Indian movement, mm-hmm. all of that stuff. It's the same problems from the 60s,
right,
that are still happening today. So it's like people have been talking about this on public stages. I'm definitely not the first, and I definitely hope I'm not the last. Mm. But like, hopefully I can be one of the loudest.
Mm. Yeah.
that would be nice.
Yeah.
If the message can reach more people, the more people that you reach with the message, the more likely it is that people are going to take action. And we are seeing some of that, and that is good. So on the grassroots level, I'm hopeful, but on the governmental level, I'm not.
Right. Yeah. And unfortunately, it's just the nature of the beast with government. But as you say, the grassroots level is where it's real, and it's where real difference has always been made on that level. So, you know, as you say, we just have to keep doing that and keep fighting the good fight, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Well, listen, mate, I can't thank you enough, Clifton, for taking the time to talk to me. It's been a real honour to get to know you and hear your insights. And I salute you, my friend. You're a great man, a great comic, and can't wait for us to do the fantastically named tours, both of them.
Yeah, same to you, same to you. Everything you just said, you're a fantastic man, fantastic comic. Thank you for talking to me. This was a real treat, and I look forward to the tours as well.
Awesome. Happy days, my friend. Have a wonderful evening, and we will speak again soon.
Yeah, talk to you later.
Thank you for listening to Mullinger Meets Canadians. If you like greatness, creativity, being inspired, laughing, or just love Canada as much as I do, then this is the podcast for you. So please do subscribe and review the show now. This show is brought to you by the Cape Breton Partnership. They are connecting entrepreneurs and companies to the resources they need to succeed on the amazing island of Cape Breton. Visit capebretonpartnership.com for more information on how you can improve your life and business by investing in Cape Breton Island. Be sure to follow Clifton on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook at Clifton Cremo, and subscribe now to his YouTube channel. He has numerous shows coming up, including at CC's Entertainment Centre in Eltsepogtog First Nation, New Brunswick on the 25th of September, and also at the Highland Arts Theatre in Sydney, Nova Scotia on October the 15th. He's also appearing at the Atlantica Hotel as part of Halifax's Best of the Fest tour on October the 29th. He's a busy guy. He's doing great things. Be sure to check out a show soon. Further details can be found on the Edit website, maritimeedit.com, and I will see you next time.
Podstarter.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.